This webcast is made possible in part by support from the listener members of the Classical Network, WWFM and WWFM.org. Thank you for your support. Cadenza, winner of the Deems Taylor Virgil Thompson Award for Broadcasting, is a production of the Classical Network. Funding for this program is made possible by the listener members of the Classical Network. I'm David Ozenberg, your host. Last Friday night, we launched a new monthly broadcast series of concerts given by the Germantown, Tennessee-based Iris Orchestra, one of the real feel-good success stories on the American symphonic scene. Now entering into their 17th season, featuring top-ranked musicians and performing with top-tier soloists, Yo-Yo Ma was featured at Iris's inaugural concert back in 2000, supported by the surrounding municipality and public, and giving back to that community through an extensive outreach program, Iris Orchestra is a clear model of what can happen. And this week on Cadenza, we'll chat with their first and only artistic director and conductor, Maestro Michael Stern. He grew up surrounded by music. His father, the legendary violinist Isaac Stern, my guest did not initially turn to music, though it was inevitable. He caught on with the Cleveland Orchestra. Leonard Bernstein invited him to conduct the New York Philharmonic. He started conducting around the globe, taking directorships in France and Germany. He founded Iris, but I will leave that story to him. Since 2005, he's been music director and lead conductor of the Kansas City Symphony and is recording with that wonderful ensemble. Last Friday night's initial monthly broadcast of Iris Orchestra featured exactly what the group wishes to do, mixing works of composers like Beethoven, with new American works, many commissioned by Iris, as the program also featured the world premiere of a violin concerto by Bruce Adolf. Maestro Stern and I caught up with each other at the Domenis Center in New York City a while back when he was there guest conducting another great ensemble, the Orchestra of St. Luke's.
I'm happy to be here today with Maestro Michael Stern. So the Classical Network's going to start broadcasting concerts by an orchestra you founded back in 2000, no? And that is the Iris Orchestra. Amidst all these past years where the news about orchestras of any size making music can be anywhere from good to not relevant to scary, this is a success story, it seems. I thought you'd tell us the story, tell our listeners the story, and if you can include in there why, location, name, mission agenda, programming, loyalty of your musicians, level of the soloist, loyalty of the audience, and engagement in the community. I know it's a lot, but that's your outline for your story.
Tell us
the story, Iris, because it's a great story.
I should just start talking and tell you the story?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
The founding of Iris, it was a moment of grace, actually, and it was an interesting journey because I had no idea it was coming. I didn't set out to do it. And I can't say completely it happened by accident, but it sort of evolved in a very organic way, but from a very unexpected place. So it started with a concert for which I was engaged with my friend Yo-Yo Ma, who had agreed to come and play a concert, a one-off gig, with the Memphis Symphony at a venue which had opened only a couple, 3 years, 2.5 years before. And that was the Germantown Performing Arts Center in Germantown, Tennessee, which is a adjacent community to Memphis. And I accepted. I mean, you know, it's always fun to work with Yo-Yo, which we've done a lot. And I had the time, and it was an easy 2 days to come down and do it. And I had never worked with the Memphis Symphony, and I wasn't quite sure what the particulars were, but we made a program. And I went down and we started rehearsing. And at one point, maybe on a break, I looked at him and I said, "Why exactly are we here? Was there an underlying subtext?" And he said, "Yeah, you don't know about the scholarship fund." And I said, "What scholarship fund?" So this is really the genesis of Iris. The guy who was running the Performing Arts Center at the time, the founding executive director, was a man named Albert Pertalion, whose background had been in literature and theater, not so much in music, but he had been entrusted with this job of running the Performing Arts Center and was looking for two things. In the context of our being there together, he had grown children, now was remarried, had a young son, and he wanted his kid, who was coming of age 4 or 5 years old, to study music. And for whatever reason, in their wisdom, the collective governments of Memphis and Shelby County and Germantown and whatever had seriously cut the budget in the school so that the arts programs were decimated that year. And Albert, in typical fashion, said, "Well, the hell with that. We're going to make a string program here at the Performing Arts Center." And so it turned out that this concert that we did together was to launch that initiative. And in fact, we grossed enough money, it was well over $110,000, I think, in that one evening, to begin the string program, which continues 18 years later, 19 years later, to this day. And it's kind of an amazing thing, right? Mm-hmm. So that was an eye-opening thing for me, and it was a wake-up call. And then, picking me up from the airport, this guy, Albert Pertellian, whom I had never met, said, I think we need a resident group at the Germantown Performing Arts Center, and I've thought about this a lot, and it can't be a full orchestra. The Memphis Symphony exists in town, and they play in our hall, and that's not what we're looking for. I don't want a brass band. The string quartet is too small. I've thought of various chamber groups, and I think a flexible-sized orchestra is just the ticket, and you're the person to do it. And I said to him, with all due respect, you don't know me, and we've never met. And he said, oh, no, I've looked into you. I don't know, it was some crazy story. And I sort of discounted him immediately. And I was pretty myopic about the whole thing and probably not, you know, it was not my best open-minded moment. Mm. And I said, why do you want a group in this place? And his answer took me by surprise. And he said, I've lived in London, I've lived in Chicago, I am a Southerner by birth, and it occurs to me that the South has long traditions of literature, of architecture, of horticulture, of cooking, of blues music, of all kinds of things, but not classical music. Mm-hmm. And then the next thing out of his mouth, I thought, was going to be some Elvis reference, that he wanted to have some kind of musical identity at the center. And instead he said, I don't see why this should be, and I'm interested in making the Germantown Performing Arts Center, with this group that we would form, a home to every composer in the United States. So now, you know, the conversation changed and he's talking my language, and I thought, wow, that's pretty inspiring and kind of enterprising at the same time. But I immediately discounted it again because I'm, you know, pushing his buttons, and I said, you don't know what it costs. He said, you'll tell me. I said, but you won't be able to afford it. He said, I will. And I said, who's going to pay for it? And he said, the city. And I said, Albert, there is no municipally funded orchestra in the United States. It doesn't exist. This is not Europe. And he said, let me do it. And sure enough, the first time he applied to the Board of Aldermen, they turned him down. And I was music director in Germany at the time, in Saarbrücken, Germany. And I remember getting the call. And he said, well, we had the meeting last night, and I put this plan forward, and they said no. And I thought to myself, you know, I expected it. And Albert, we'll get him next time. He said, well, I'm going to hold you to that. If I get the money and I come back to you, you have to say yes. And I said, yeah, okay. And sure enough, he came back and he got it. And for the first 5.5 years, I think 6 years of our existence, we were in fact the only municipally funded orchestra in the United States. And the group, right from the get-go, broke every rule. Right. So it is not a pickup group. We have an absolute family, a collection of devoted musicians, but they are culled from every walk of life of American musical landscape. Right. So we have people playing in major orchestras. We have people freelancing in major cities. We have people on the faculties of conservatories and music schools. We have people playing in ballet orchestras and opera orchestras. We have people studying as undergraduates, as graduate students. We have people living in the United States, all over. We have people even who have moved to Europe and who arrange their vacations to coincide with concert week so they can come back and play. It's kind of amazing. Mm. Yeah? And there are no titled chairs in the orchestra. Everybody rotates. So somebody playing concertmaster 1 week could sit in the second violins. A person playing first oboe on the first half could be playing second oboe on the second half. There's an incredible spirit of collegiality and conviviality and democracy, even in the rehearsal process. And we have this joy at finding ourselves with each of these weeks and in these programs. We've attracted an incredible list of people who have come to play with us. And it's like a who's who, both of people who now are well-known but were not when they first played with us because they were so young, and people who were already stars, and everybody in between. And it's the incredible connection with the community and with the audience that makes the difference. So people flying in all over. We have great identification with the community. We have an outreach program which is crazy busy. We come in on a Tuesday or a Wednesday, and there's nothing but, you know, a schedule of events all the way through the week. We've now moved to giving doubles. So we perform Saturday night and Sunday afternoon. And in the process, we go to schools and hospitals, and we give outreach in every way, manner, shape, and form. And it's a kind of amazing impact that the group has had in these 16 years. We're looking at our 17th season next year. And it really is a source of incredible joy and a feeling of real accomplishment that music can matter from a place and a beginning that we would not have predicted or expected.
All right, so very briefly, the name.
The name, so we were playing around with names, and we had all sorts of bad names considered. And in the end, people thought IRIS was an acronym. It's not. IRIS is the state flower of Tennessee.
Okay.
But it's also part of the way you see. And we were trying to give this idea that we were going to have a new way of looking at, not only a new way of looking at music, but a new way of looking at the role of music in the community.
So here is the IRIS Orchestra, led by their artistic director and conductor, and my guest today, Maestro Michael Stern, in a work commissioned by IRIS and featuring a world-class soloist, the great clarinetist Richard Stoltzman, and music by American composer Stephen Hartke, from his clarinet concerto subtitled Landscapes with Blues, the movements reflecting geographic regions that have had a huge influence on the composer, one movement about the Philly-New York corridor, one, which I played on my cadenza with Mr. Stoltzman a few weeks back, about the River Delta blues, and the opening movement we hear here influenced by West Africa, the movement called Senegambia. Thank you.
One of those fish hooks that Albert got in you was the, we're going to promote American music. You do that, but did the repertoire expand over the years? So now you do standard orchestral rep mixed in with premieres on. I mean, it's
well,
a
we
real
all,
mix.
We always did that.
Okay.
We
okay.
always did
okay,
that. Okay, so, you know, we commissioned a piece by Stephen Hartke in the very first year. We've commissioned a piece every year, right. I think. But we've also done a lot of sort of music off the beaten path, and we have a pretty healthy concentration of American composers.
Right.
Certainly the composers that we commissioned have been almost exclusively American-born. I mean, I do new music all the time, but there is a special responsibility to this idea that when you have this startup, this kind of intrepid, insane adventure, and it's going to be a really American group, we should take care of American music somehow. So we've worked with, you know, like I said, Stephen Hartke and Ned Roram and Richard Danielpour and Ellen Tafswillick. And I mean, we're always looking for interesting ideas how to make programs. And that includes old music and new music.
Mm. So first of all, I told our listeners, it's a great story. So the follow-up question, which ran through your head when Albert was trying to pitch you, why doesn't this happen, occur more often around the country? And want to throw two, is it because there isn't someone like an Albert? And also, I mean, the caliber of musician you have in Iris, the soloists, modesty aside, some of it has to do with you being there too. Is that the reason this doesn't translate to other parts of the country, even though?
Well, I mean, I don't know. There are interesting things going on in other parts of the country.
Yeah.
There's no orchestra that's completely modeled on this idea of democracy and so forth. I mean, I don't figure myself that when I imagine why Iris is Iris, the first thing I think about is not me. I think word of mouth. Well, first of all, I think the proof is in the pudding. So when people come down and have this rather extraordinary experience of being with people who are just so, there's just so much energy on stage combined with a really high level of playing, and people are so flexible. So you have these, you know, great sort of adventures. I once invited my friend Manny Axe to come down, and he and Yoko Nozaki, his wife, who I adore, the two of them, and they wanted to play the Bartok together, and they also played Mozart to piano, right? And just the fun of being able to do that in this incredibly, not experimental, but this free environment where we could, you know, rehearse and not worry about the clock and just, I mean, I think the secret is, yeah, the word of mouth helps a lot. People want to come and play with us. And the people who have played with us in the group always want to come back, right? In fact, now the group has expanded because at some points, you know, we had to get more people for repertoire reasons. And then, you know, you want to keep it sort of fair and people are, but everybody wants to play everything. And so when they are now available to play all the concerts in the season and they only get asked to play 75 or 80% of the concerts, they get a little upset. So, right? There's that. Then there's also this feeling of there's a complete absence of routine, right? So even people who have a regular gig will take off from that gig or make time because they just want the experience of coming and having this sort of free. It's a little bit like when you remember how things were if you were in a really good place as a student and the orchestra's really good. It might have been an exalted level as a student orchestra, but you didn't have the rigor and the pressure and the constraint of it being, quote unquote, a job. And the joy of just gearing up for a concert and then doing it, right? That remains, except that we're all, you know, at a different place in our lives, and it just is what it is. But the happiness of trying to achieve that sort of unusual moment of getting to your goal for the week, that's special.
Well, last thing, was he right about another thing about the fact, and this isn't disparaging about any parts of the country, but that a Southern audience wanted this? You've been embraced by the people down there?
We have a very loyal following down there. It's not a home run right now anywhere in the United States to make the case for the arts, but I think groups like this advocate powerfully for the benefit of it, because that community would be much the poorer for it without Iris and all the ancillary things that we do in the community. And at the same time, it introduces to that part of the world a density of musicians at that level that they would not get, and a parade of guests that, you know, would be the envy of a lot of other places in bigger cities. So, I mean, just reading through the names of the people who have been with us in 16 years is interesting.
It's impressive. It's not interesting. It's impressive and interesting. A little bit about you, and indulge me here for a second, but you and I are the same age, and I have two...
Condolences.
Yeah, thanks. And I have two sons. And our older son, both my wife and I are musicians and all that, and by degrees and all. And our older son, they're both wonderful musicians, both kids. But he loves music, and he graduated, and he went to college up in Boston. He thought, I have to do an engineering degree because I've seen my parents in music. But now he's in music.
What does he play?
Oh, he plays all kinds of stuff. Trumpet, but he's into an alternative rock scene. He plays all that stuff. And he does bands. He writes. He manages. He's really incredible. But not to compare households, but you grew up, you know, with your father, and I don't know what the atmosphere is like in the home, but, I mean, you went and got a history degree at Harvard College, and then Curtis with studying. Was it just a foregone conclusion you were going to do music, or was there actually a, I'm not sure if I want to type of thing?
No, it was far from a foregone conclusion, and yeah, it was partially, I'm not sure I want to, and also partially we had no push at all to do it.
Okay.
And in fact, my parents, and my father particularly, was, if not adamantly opposed, then clearly not motivated or enthusiastic about getting his children to become professional musicians. That said, it was inconceivable with their European backgrounds that we should not have music around all the time. I mean, for people of that generation, for anybody coming from Europe especially, the idea that music would not be part and parcel of any kid's education was just a non-starter. So we all started with piano lessons. I started violin lessons at 3 and a half. And I had my moments of rebellion. I mean, I did, you know, Juilliard pre-college and, I, you know, all of those. Yeah. But I was never motivated because I was never pushed to do it. And I didn't practice in that way. And it was just not, you know. And also, my father was a pretty educated guy who never went to school. I don't mean college. He never went to school, period. He never went to primary school. He never went to high school. So, you know, here he is sort of making his way pretty well in the world. And, you know, he knew how to read a book. But now his first generation children had the opportunity to go to college. This is every immigrant's dream, right? And my parents were committed to having my sister, my brother, and me go to college and go out in the world. I'm not necessarily sure that they would have preferred us to become, you know, lawyers, doctors, or CPAs. So I don't know if I went and got a, I got a history degree because I certainly went to a liberal arts college not thinking I was going to become a musician, obviously. And I sort of gravitated almost haphazardly by my interest to history, and specifically to American history. But of course, then I wrote my thesis on music, right? I wrote my thesis on the role of the arts and American music in the New Deal.
Did he discourage, or not discourage, but he didn't push, or both your parents didn't push, because he knew of the life it was? Or was it the thing of they wanted to see you all graduate college, something he didn't have?
Oh, yes and yes and yes. If we had a couch and you wanted to charge me for 50 minutes.
Because, you know, one thinks that, you know, he was so successful, so well known that it's not like that struggle was, you know, gig to gig to gig and, you know, all this kind of stuff.
He certainly struggled at the beginning, but then there came a time when he struggled a little less.
Yeah.
Maybe he thought we were not going to have an easy time of it, or maybe he didn't want the competition, or maybe he didn't think we were good enough, or maybe he didn't want to be embarrassed. You know, there's all of that multi-layered dysfunction going on. And at the same time, he was very, I mean, both my parents were incredibly loving to us. They showed it differently. You know, it wasn't always easy, but I think in the end, I have to believe that both of them were proud of us. I mean, my sister, Shira, is a very successful rabbi in New Jersey. My brother is also a very busy working conductor living in Europe and doing a lot of opera, but also performing in the United States. And I don't know how these things happen, you know. I think once we started to stand on our own 2 feet, they wanted to participate in that which made us stand on our own 2 feet. So my father played concerts with me and with my brother as much as the time remaining, you know, between the time that we became adults and the time that he passed away. He never played with Iris, interestingly enough. That's a story in itself, because when I first told him that I was thinking of doing this and then I was going to do it, he completely dismissed the idea. Completely dismissed the idea. He thought that Tennessee was way off the beaten path, and he didn't know why I was diverting. I was quite busy in Europe especially, but also with a lot of work in the United States, and he thought it was a distraction, and he didn't per se try to talk me out of it, but he was clearly not advocating for it. And then came the first year. And the first year we had Yo-Yo Ma, we had Garrick Olson, we had Richard Stoltzman, we had a whole bunch of people. And then little by little, all the word starts to trickle down. You know, this is pretty hot down there. And then he comes to me in like March or April and he goes, you don't ask me to play with you? I'm like, what? You didn't? Anyway, so I asked him to play and it was going to be the December concert of the second year and he passed away in September. Right. And then I had a problem. So I thought at first I was going to cancel the program. That was a really weird moment for me because here was this thing. I wasn't sure it was going to survive. I did not know in the second year that we were going to make it through 17 years still going strong and establish this kind of identity. We were still making it up with, you know, paper clips and rubber bands. And the concert fell on Beethoven's birthday. And we had a completely different program. I didn't want to do, but now, his absence and Beethoven's birthday, and I sort of got this light in my head. My father, at the end of his playing days, had no greater joy than playing with people who were younger than he and just, you know, completely like-minded. And some of those lovely recordings that they made in those piano quartet cycles were with Jamie Laredo, Yo-Yo Ma, and Manny X. And so I thought it was completely fitting to ask the three remaining members of that quartet to play the Beethoven triple on Beethoven's birthday. And they immediately said yes, God bless them. And we changed the program. In fact, we had to change the date because Yo-Yo and Manny, I think, were opening Verizon Hall in Philadelphia the night before, which is when the concert had been scheduled for. So we changed it for the next day. Boom, they flew in, we rehearsed. We played. It was a one-day thing, and it was an incredibly emotional thing to say just one last little goodbye. You should have been here. You could have been here. You would have been here. Yeah, you're still here. Mm. And these three guys are helping me say goodbye.
Here again is the Iris Orchestra, led by my guest, Michael Stern, and featuring great solo artists and also American music, the Mazurka Movement from Ned Roram's Double Concerto for Violin and Cello, the soloists Jamie Laredo and Sharon Robinson.
on your path, a couple points, Cleveland. That was a pretty heady thing.
Cleveland was an amazing, amazing point of great good fortune for me. Because coming right out of Curtis, I mean, having the education I did at Curtis was a fantastic thing. Curtis remains and was at that time an incredibly special place. Mm. And the musician that I became, that I have become, is in large measure because of not only the people that I met there and the people I played music with there. I was there as a player as well. And just the bonds of friendship and musical connection that I made there. But also, of course, my great teacher, Max Rudolph, who was an incredibly inspiring presence in my life. And right out of Curtis, I auditioned for and was given the job at Cleveland as the assistant conductor. And that was an amazing thing because, again, I hit Cleveland at exactly the right moment. I mean, the orchestra was peerless. It still is one of the great orchestras, and it's an orchestra I love. In those days, they still had a lot of the tradition and reflection from the Zell era. Mazel also, but people talked about Zell like he was still in the room.
Right.
And at the same time, Dohnányi, with whom I've become very close ever since I was his assistant back in 1986, was really working hard to use everything from that past tradition in a good way, but bring it forward, mm-hmm. right? And the orchestra was unbelievably open with me and lovely and ruthless, right? So I would get up there and I was young and they'd say, oh, this was really great, these two things. Now, here's a list of the 13 things which really were not good, and you've got to do them better. And it was an incredible education.
Yeah.
And the other thing was, I was incredibly lucky, both with Ken Haas, rest his soul, and then Tom Morris, who came after him as executive director, that they set the tone that they included me in everything. And I have to say, now that I'm music director in Kansas City and I go around the country and have contact with a lot of orchestras, everything that I learned in Cleveland, in some way, I used. Sometimes as a cautionary tale, but much, much more, this is the way things really get done. There was a spirit of trust and communication and this devotion, this single-minded dedication to trying to make it better than the last rehearsal, to trying to make this program better than the last one. That there was this feeling, this kind of unrelenting drive to be as good as you can be. And that comes from inside. It's not because they were motivated by the contract or by press or by vanity. It was just, we are the Cleveland Orchestra, and this is what we should be doing.
Huh.
And that stuck with me for all the right reasons. I mean, it was an unusual level of
especially
inspiration.
Especially to see it at that point in your career, too.
Well, I was young and soaking everything up. Yeah. And the friends that I made in the orchestra there, I still keep to this day.
Before we get to KC, one more point, you know, timing-wise. You mentioned Saarbrücken. You were there kind of when it's a big recording orchestra.
Yeah.
And you were there when CDs were hitting their absolute peak as far as stuff coming out and labels just reeking in heyday, which, of course, has passed. Did that sort of lock you into what an orchestra could do outside of the concert stage?
No, and it's a very different thing. I would say that, in fact, we didn't make that many CDs in Saarbrücken because we were a radio orchestra.
Right.
So our meat and potatoes was to perform concerts for the radio.
Okay.
So a lot of what we did was recorded all the time, but not necessarily commercial CDs. We did make some commercial CDs, and, you know, they recorded a lot with Stanislav Skrobachevsky since I've been there. But the whole mission of radio orchestras in Europe is going to change if it hasn't changed already. After World War II, there was a very specific reason for those radio orchestras to be, and it was all state-subsidized, and, you know, they didn't care if they had an audience or not because that was not what the point. Their point was to play everything. You know, the newest music, the most unlistenable music, the greatest music, the best of the new music, best of the old music, everything. I mean, the level of discrimination in the programming was somehow less important than just getting that stuff done. And that was an education, too. I will confess that I came to that job maybe not at the best intersection of time in my life with experience. You have to be strong to work in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And I am strong now, but I don't know that I was so strong then.
Well, 11 years now on with KC. Many of our listeners might say, oh, Kansas City Symphony, you know, a voice that appears on our airwaves every Monday through Friday, Bill McLaughlin spent a little time in front of KC. But, I mean, what was the orchestra when you got there? Accomplishments, briefly, what you've brought them to?
Well, I wouldn't use the phrase what I've brought them to. Again, it's not about me. But what we have done together,
yeah.
I'm pretty proud of. I mean, I will say I appreciated very much earlier that you said this is a good story about Iris, as
yeah.
a good news story. Kansas City Symphony is a very good news story. The orchestra was not in great shape when I took it. It had gone through some very tough times. It had a sketchy artistic history, but also financially, and the prospects for success in the community were challenged. And it took a little while to get all the pieces of the puzzle in place, but I think the great achievement of the last 11 years, and we are only getting going. I mean, I really think that there is no real limit to what we can accomplish there except what we impose on ourselves, is this wonderful team. I mean, of course, there are individuals who played a huge role in this. Shirley Helzberg was for years and years the president of the board and chairman of the board. And she completely changed the culture of the place. The financial stability of the orchestra improved tremendously. Already had started to a little bit before I got there, but since I've been there, that's an incredible success story. Our executive director, Frank Byrne, we have an unbelievable staff. The orchestra committees, the orchestra per se, and all of our staff and all of our board just have agreed to agree to see eye to eye. And when there's a point of negotiation, there's not acrimony. There's just, let's sit down. We're going to work it out. We do. We move on. I go to places. I'm astonished that board members, they don't even go to concerts, let alone support the orchestra. And we have an incredible feeling of dedication, devotion on the board. All of our board members are concert goers. They all have subscriptions. They're cheerleaders in the community for the orchestra and we for them. There is this sense of complicity that we're going to make something great happen. And 4 years ago, with the help of a lot of incredible people, Julia Irene Kaufman at the head of it and the Kaufman Foundation, the Muriel McBride Kaufman Foundation, we built a new performing arts center, which has a wonderful sort of opera ballet pit theater, but also Helzberg Hall, which is one of the great acoustics and stages in the country. And everybody, Chicago Symphony has played there not too long ago. The LA Phil played there. Everybody was raving about the hall. It's the same acoustician as Disney Hall, Yasu Toyoda, with a beautiful design by Moshe Safdie. But it's better, I think, than a lot of other places. And we are incredibly fortunate. We have, 4 years in a row of surplus. And we've made these recordings, which are getting incredible critical reference. Yeah, but I think the greatest point of pride is that the orchestra is, it's a happy band. And we program well. And again, we're attracting a wonderful list of collaborative artists, of soloists to come and work with us, but also of real connection in the community, which is making the case that music can take its rightful place at the center of the life of the city. Mm-hmm. A kind of obvious example of that, probably one that's been talked about too much over the last year or two, has been the fact that we were right there at the forefront of the Royals winning the World Series.
So not sure if the Royals will make it back to the World Series this year, but here is my guest, Maestro Michael Stern, in front of that other orchestra he leads, the Kansas City Symphony, in the final march movement from Paul Hindemith's Symphonic Metamorphosis of Themes by Carl Maria von Weber. Thank you.
Well, it sounds like, you know, Kansas City's been a great success story for the metropolitan area, but I wanted to just ask two questions here. One, looking back on American Symphony Orchestra, and then forward. The level of musician playing these orchestras is just tremendous. I mean, we do a program every Monday night where we're presenting programs of the great music schools, Kurtz and all the rest of these, and the level of playing in that is amazing. So these are the musicians going out and filling the orchestras. To those that cling to the old notion of the big five and everybody else's B or C or A, that really needs to go away, doesn't it? I mean, there's some incredible orchestras that on a given night, that whole phrase, but from coast to coast, these orchestras are stacked with phenomenal musicians, great maestros, and the orchestra playing is healthy on every and almost endless points on the map, is it not?
Yes.
Yeah.
The answer to that question, very simply, is yes.
Yes.
But the more nuanced response would be, I think the idea of the big five right from the get-go was a little silly. But in those days, anything that wasn't a big city was somehow suspect, and it was all provincial and regional. And but remember, Cleveland Orchestra was among the big five.
Yes, it was. Yeah.
Cleveland was always seen as a provincial place, right? And in fact, one could argue that the reason that even before Zell got there, that Rudzinski could start to make such a great orchestra. Remember, they had Rudzinski, they had Leinsdorf, and then Zell got there and made magic happen. Was because they were in this protected place where they could just infuse everything they did with excellence and then go out in the world and say, look what we did. A lot of places are doing that. It's just we're doing it in the age of the internet.
Right.
I mean, look, some of the orchestras of the world that have far bigger budgets than we and far greater reputations with long recording legacies are capable of playing not such interesting concerts. On the other hand, I will be the first to say that the New York Philharmonic, the Cleveland Orchestra, the Chicago Symphony, the Philadelphia Orchestra, the Boston Symphony are great orchestras, period. And it's not because they're in the Big Five or not in the Big Five. They have a tradition and a standard and a level of playing and a commitment to music. And most importantly, in all five of those places, a connection with their community, which is organizationally defining. And maybe that didn't happen as much at a very high level in other places, but it certainly, for all the reasons you said, is happening now. I mean, when Kansas City was still not even on the map of what a good orchestra should be doing, you had all of a sudden articles being written, but hold on, LA is really good, San Francisco is really good, St. Louis is really good. And people were saying, well, this Pittsburgh, great orchestra.
Houston, Dallas down on the south.
So you have this idea of, oh, the club is expanding, right? But also people are moving around a lot more, right? So there are people who have been in Chicago and been in Philadelphia who want to hear music at that level. And you're absolutely right. The musicians who are populating the audition lists of various places is just getting better and better. The level of talent in this country is incredible. But I would also argue that while not uniformly the case, orchestras not in those five big cities or big orchestra centers always played better than people thought. And anyway, I love the idea of trying to make America better for culture and for the arts. And it's not that we can't be. I mean, this is one of the things you learn when you study American history. We have a responsibility to be honest critics of our society because it's the only way we're going to make it better. But at the same time, you have to try to make it better. And I truly believe with all my heart that the American musical landscape is not well served by a trickle-down theory of high culture, even in the age of simulcasts and internet and YouTube broadcasts. It is absolutely inspiring to see how many semi-professional and reading orchestras and regional orchestras are populated by people who love music and are committed to the idea that music and the arts are essential to their lives. Mm-hmm. And the reason that's important is, number one, it changes the way they see the world. It changes the way they act in the world. It changes the way they raise their children. And it changes how they let their voices be heard in the world. And so if we can make the case, as we are in Kansas City or with Iris in Tennessee, that by what we do, music can make that community, the lives of the people who live there, and the way we see the world in those places different and better, then it's worth pouring all of your strength into it. And I really do think that because of this single-minded understanding that this is worth doing and it really matters and it's important, it's why Kansas City is succeeding and it's why Iris is succeeding. Mm-hmm. And the models for those two places are completely different. But in the end, it's all about music.
Well, that kind of answers my other side, because there are those that say, and they have stories to back them up. I mean, when you look at the Philadelphia going over the edge of bankruptcy and even you have a rope pulled down and pulled back up, saying these symphony orchestras, especially, you know, the large ones or the major metropolitan ones, they've passed their relevance. Yes, they are the vehicles that can give us the great symphonic works, but in a day and age where we have all this other stuff, they don't adapt, they don't bring in the audience, that is going to be the next. I mean, there's all these arguments that the symphony orchestra is losing its relevance. I mean, George Lucas once said that the big movie theater will eventually lose its relevance as far as presenting, except for big action pictures. So, I'm just curious what your thought is there. I mean, that's the doomsayers of where the symphony orchestra is going in the
right,
next 20
but
years.
There are movie theaters filled with people for more than just action movies.
Yeah.
The reason for that is exactly the reason why you come to concerts. Because to experience performance, and movies are not quite the same because it's not a live performance, but you can't get a ticket to Hamilton on Broadway.
Right.
And there are a lot of shows that are sold out, and it's not that easy. I mean, that's the other thing. Kansas City, Iris, and in a lot of other places, hearing a concert is a bargain compared to what you fork over for a Broadway show or even for a sporting event.
Right.
And nobody really makes that case forcibly enough. But I do think that the reasons for that are the same. And it's more the same for live theater and concerts than it is for a movie or any kind of electronic or installation artistic experience. But the act of going out of your house to experience that is motivated by the same human need to feel connection and to have experiences shared in the society of people around you. Why is it that in moments of crisis, 9/11, an earthquake in San Francisco, there's an earthquake in San Francisco, it devastates the city. The symphony announces it's going out to, you know, Candlestick Park or wherever, and they're going to play Beethoven 9, and the place is mobbed.
Mm-hmm.
And one could even argue maybe the safest place for you in the city is in your house. After 9/11, you could argue that people were afraid to go out. It was a nightmare, right? It wasn't a nightmare. People were coming together in the city like one had rarely seen in one's lifetime. Why? Because you need connection. And music, at the end of the day, is only about that. It's about connection and it's about communication. It's about the human breath being able to express wordlessly something to another human being and change the interaction. And that's why music is always going to matter. Now, the Philadelphia Orchestra, Minnesota Orchestra, Atlanta Symphony, all having issues, it is not because those musicians are bad musicians. Far from it. And I'm not going to opine on my view. I think once in a while one can say that the conditions have to be more adaptable and flexible to the realities of the 21st century economics and the way leisure time is allotted among the audience and so forth. But I also think when an organization is well run and when the spirit of the board and the management and the musicians is unified into an understanding which moves the organization forward, then almost anything is possible. If those things are not in place, it almost doesn't matter how badly the audience wants music or how well the orchestra players or the organization produces music. It's simply not going to work. And, you know, I'm not a finger-pointing guy, but I think in Kansas City, we are incredibly lucky to have enlightened leadership, inspired protection from the board, and a committed sense of real devotion and activism. I mean, we have people in Kansas City who are doing things in the community and volunteering for things and working with our education department and, you know, also fantastic education department. And at Iris, we have everybody who comes down volunteering for this outreach stuff that we do, which is getting more and more involved. And we're about to launch a pilot program of mentoring chamber music, using chamber music groups to foster real community engagement and outreach in the city, which is going to be unique, I think. Hmm. I mean, it's not rocket science, right? You treat people with respect. You are all agreeing to be in the boat together, rowing in the same direction. And then the good stuff just takes care of itself.
Yeah, I just brought up the Lucas analogy in that the orchestra doesn't become as great as the music is, but the orchestra doesn't become the vehicle where all they play are the Mahler and the Bruckner and the big romantic tone poems and these things, which are suited for. They are the instrument for playing that music, but that it has to be relevant to the community. It has to bring the newest music forward, to bring in people of music of our time.
Absolutely.
Rather than just so that's
absolutely.
Well, two great stories you gave us with Kansas City and Iris. I'm really glad we're going to be broadcasting the Iris concerts. I know our listeners will really enjoy them. Thanks for the time. I close all my Cadenz interviews by asking my guests the same two questions. And the first is a hypothetical, which says if you could chat like we've been chatting with someone from the past who you never had a chance to. First name that pops in. Don't think about it too long. You get swamped. The first name, when I said that, you're thinking about it very long.
Noel. I mean, I guess the first person.
Yeah, what was the first name that popped in when I said that?
Mahler.
Yeah.
Only because I think he was a pretty interesting guy. And I say it, I mean, if I thought about it, I might change my mind. But one of the formative experiences in my life was the fact that my parents were so friendly with the Bernsteins. And Lenny, to this day, is somebody that I hold up as an ideal simply because of his extraordinary ability in music. It's not that you agreed with everything that he did, but what he couldn't do was very little.
Yeah.
I mean, the guy, he was music personified, and my father loved him, and I was incredibly influenced by him and loved talking to him. And he was a pretty complicated guy. And he identified with Mahler, and I think about the layers upon layers upon layers of weirdly psychological intricate dysfunction and achievement and genius and self-questioning. And I just think that's a very interesting conversation to have. You said musician or just anybody?
It could be anybody. I've had everybody from God to Groucho Marx and everybody in between. But, I mean, usually. And conductors I've had over the years. Bach is the runaway number one answer from everybody. But Mahler is the common ground for many conductors. Yeah.
Well, not so much because his music is the only one that I identify with at that exalted level. There are many.
Yeah.
And I think people who, you know, claim to be exclusive Mahlerians.
Yeah.
Mahlerites?
Mahlerians.
My teacher's jaundiced opinion about this was, if you want to be considered an expert in something, just keep doing it over and over again. It doesn't really have to be good. Just keep doing it over and over again, and people will say you're an expert because you've made it a specialty. But there are people who really know something special about certain things, and I think Lenny...
Yeah.
But I just think from an intellectual point of view, I mean, from a... Oh, God, that's a hard question. Because, you know, do you really want to sit down and have a conversation with Brahms or Beethoven? It might be very unpleasant. So the conversation, you know.
Yeah. But, well, Brahms, yeah, he'd have to like you. And Beethoven would just be difficult on all fronts.
On all fronts, yeah.
Final question is a non-musical question. Everybody I interview on Cadenza fills their life with music. You're very busy. We're here talking because you're conducting the Orchestra St. Luke's and Kansas City and Iris. But when you have to do something non-musical, take yourself away from it, respite, pleasure, relaxation, enjoyment, what do you do?
Well, I have two kids,
yeah.
So that should answer the question. And when I'm home, you know, kids, my wife also loves to cook. I love to cook. I love to eat. Did I mention I love to eat? I love to cook. I love to eat.
It's cause and effect.
And I like movies a lot.
You get time for?
You know, plane rides. I'm not a big Netflix guy.
Yeah,
that's not so much time.
Michael Stern, thanks for taking some time.
No, I loved our conversation. Thanks.
Maestro Michael Stern, the Classical Network, will continue their newly launched monthly concert series presenting performances by the Iris Orchestra, led by Maestro Stern, with the next broadcast scheduled for Friday night, October 14th at 8. You can check the Iris Orchestra out even further at their website, irisorchestra.org. Last Friday's inaugural broadcast ended with one of the great groundbreaking symphonies in the repertoire, thanks to Beethoven. And I leave with those final moments once again, the Iris Orchestra led by their artistic director and conductor and my guest today, Michael Stern. And as always, I'm glad you were in the audience today, and I hope you'll join me here each week for a chat with the great classical musicians of our area and the globe. Remember, you can catch any recent past Cadenza program by going to www.fm.org and clicking on webcasts. I ask you to please support this and the many specialty programs we offer by making your donation today at our website. Thank you, and thanks for listening. I'm David Ozenberg, and this has been Cadenza, winner of the Deems Taylor Virgil Thompson Award for Broadcasting and an exclusive production of the Classical Network and WWFM.org.